I'm Jim Haskell, Senior Portfolio Strategist. Earlier this autumn, we collaborated with one of our clients on a multi-part exploration of U.S.-China relations. I'm excited to introduce a three-part series that will run over the next couple of weeks on the different dimensions of the U.S.-China relationship and their implications for investors. Joining me in this series are three people with extensive experience in the U.S.-China realm. I welcome Ray Dalio, our founder and co-CIO, Kevin Rudd, the former Prime Minister of Australia, and David McCormick, our CEO and a former senior official in the Treasury and Commerce Departments, as well as the National Security Council in the George W. Bush administration. The conversations you will see in this series are drawn from a video cast with Ray, Kevin, and David, and from a live session with our client, which was captured on audio. Excerpts from these two sessions will make up the content for this series. Throughout this series, you will hear us refer to three different scenarios for how the relationship could evolve. First, a high-friction scenario, similar to the current path of increased tensions. Second, a lower-friction scenario, wherein the two countries reach a sort of détente. And third, an unlikely scenario marked by major reforms to China's policies and a return to the engagement model of the past decades. In this installment, Ray, Kevin, and David discuss the arc of the U.S.-China relationship, how we got to this point, and where we might go from here. In part two of the series, Ray, Kevin, and David will survey the domains of economic competition between the U.S. and China, and they will consider how trade, technology, and capital control policies may change in the coming decade. And finally, part three will look at the different dimensions of U.S.-China tensions on global markets, and the implications for investors. Ray and Kevin will discuss how Chinese economic policy may evolve, and Ray will explore the importance of diversification and what that means in this new environment. We hope you enjoy the series on this most important topic. To set the stage for this discussion of the U.S.-China relationship, I'd like to begin by considering how we even got to the current moment. And Ray, I'd like to begin with you. Would you please put China's current position in context? How does Xi Jinping fit into the arc of China's development?
He is an extension of many different forces that have been into place over China's 4,000-year history and how empires and dynasties rise and decline. They have in their heads an understanding of that process. And so the top-down model is one that is somewhat similar to other dynasties and an emperor rising and going through the arc of a dynasty. You have to view Xi's power as just part of that arc. And that arc is the greatest force. And it's what everyone agrees that they're pursuing. So you have to have that in your mind. So when we say, where will China be 10 years from now, they understand in the Deng era, in that era, it was to gain financial and other strengths without being threatening to the outside world, to do that quietly in an unthreatening way, which continued pretty much until 2008. They could be threatening. Then things happen, populism, our own problems in the United States and in the world, loss of jobs to Chinese and such things produced a tension, as well as their development became obvious and they became stronger. And so we have under Xi a country which is now more powerful and will continue to be more powerful and will operate in a manner that's consistent with that power.
David, what is the arc of the relationship from America's perspective?
In many ways, if you go back a decade or more, policymakers on the U.S. side from both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, really moved forward hoping and pursuing a course that was most akin to your third scenario. The idea that by engaging with China in a responsible way, trying to bring China into the global economy, trying to bring China into the global leadership and partnership in many institutions around the world, that would be a way to help accelerate China's introduction into a free market, the free market economy in China and the global, an integrated member of the global economy more broadly. That would lead to much more introduction of free market principles in the economy. And that would be a really force for good in terms of mitigating the risk of military adventurism, geopolitical conflict. And also, there was a bet, really, that this would lead to further liberalization within China from a human rights democracy kind of perspective. So that was the aspiration. And U.S. policy was more or less aligned with the idea of trying to encourage, incent that transition. And if we fast forward from that time, 10, 15 years ago, multiple administrations, even through the Obama administration, I think what we found is the relationship, China in particular, and the relationship in general, is moving in the other directions. In other words, it's moving away from the third scenario, though, of course, that's still a possibility, and more towards the second scenario, and possibly, as you describe in your introduction, the first scenario. And there are many drivers of that, which I'm hoping we'll discuss in this conversation, one of which is the one you started with, which is the CCP and the evolution of the CCP. And I think, importantly, the introduction of President Xi. And President Xi sort of brought forward a point of view on the world and a point of view on China's role in the world that had a certain set of implications around technology leadership, around sovereignty, around the kind of economy that China would have, the combination of sort of top-down economic management with also a hybrid of free market principles. And that has been one of the reasons that China has evolved the way it has, and the conflict between the United States and China is taking on additional momentum.
Let's shift our gaze to the future and consider how the U.S.-China relationship may evolve over the coming decade and what the high friction and detente scenarios might look like. Assuming that the United States and China continue to compete at some level, what would you expect the relationship to look like in the year 2030? Would it change materially from where we are today?
You can't break up facets of this evolution. So let's say that the conflict with the United States, there are five different types of wars that we have: a trade war, a technology war, a geopolitical war, possibly a capital war, and a military war. All of this everything has to be viewed in the context of what is the development of a dynasty or an empire, this one beginning in 1949, and its overall trajectory. You have to understand that. Then you come down to shorter and shorter time frames, which, by the way, they plan for. You were about in October, we're going to see the 2035 plan. And so you have all these plans that they then plan for, but it's all within that arc. So you can't divide those pieces up and understand them well. You have to understand the arc and then see each of those pieces as part of that arc. If I were to take, let's say, the next 5 years and take the 10 years, I'd just like to paint the picture in a holistic way. Right now, we are intertwined. And as a result, in this war, they understand, and we understand, that there's an emergence of a great power challenging an existing power. And each of them has their own set of circumstances. So what I would say is, when we look at that, China has passed the point, largely, as passing the point of dependence on the United States in the way that it had before. For example, on technology, there was the development of their technologies on top of our technologies, and we're intertwined. And so the circumstances that we face now are because we're intertwined, and that's where we are. As you go to 5 and 10 years into the future, you are either in that intervening period going to have one hell of a fight, or you're going to have them become much more self-sufficient and more expansive around the world. Because everybody knows that they don't want to be interdependent. And so the Chinese will be building technologies that will get them independent. And that'll range from everything from semiconductors to GPS to a clearing system, a financial clearing system. So as one envisions where we are going to be in 5 or 10 years, the most likely scenario is you're going to have not only a more powerful China, but you're also going to have a more independent China, and you're going to have less power on the part of the United States to be able to squeeze them the way the United States can squeeze them nowadays.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting question. The way I think about the relationship is a continuum, the U.S.-China relationship. There will be some areas that are global goods that progress absolutely by necessity requires the collaboration of the United States and China, and without that, there won't be progress. Global climate change is an example. Weapons of mass destruction, proliferation of nuclear weapons and so forth might be another. There are areas where we will compete, and increasingly that's the case. And those areas of competition are largely in these emergent technologies that have winner-take-all dynamics, have huge implications from an economic perspective, from a national security perspective, things like artificial intelligence and quantum science, some advances in microbiology, genome breakthroughs. That is, those are areas where we, I suspect, will increasingly compete. And then there will be areas that we're going to have, you know, fundamental disagreements. Taiwan is an example. Human rights is another example. And where you are on the continuum of cooperation versus conflict in those different areas is somewhat reflected in your scenarios.
In the first session, Kevin followed up on David's comments about the continuum of competition and explored the possibility of the United States and China reaching détente, what could lead to such a situation, and what it might look like.
Well, I've advocated various frameworks for détente between China and the United States myself since about 2015, within a framework of what I've described as a policy of constructive realism. What do I mean by that as a framework for the future? Being realist about where these two countries will never agree and constructing red lines consistent with the period of détente between the Soviet Union and the United States in decades gone by. While in other domains, concluding that various levels of competition and or collaboration can continue, but in the absence of the risk of all-out war, that's the nature of détente. So therefore, what we're looking at is various forms of, shall we say, conventional red lines, which would need to be drawn around the U.S.-China relationship. And in a mature relationship, you could begin to draw such red lines around the South China Sea. You could begin to draw such red lines around Taiwan. You could begin to draw such red lines around the East China Sea. Beyond that, I'm not sure what additional red lines would be drawn other than in cyber and space, which are critical. And outside the red lines, under a strategic competition scenario, you could say everything else is competitive in security terms, in foreign policy terms, in ideological terms, in economic terms, in technological terms, and in the rest. But you may also choose, as the United States and the Soviet Union did, even in the Cold War, to combine and collaborate, for example, on global campaigns against polio and areas of global public health collaboration. So I think those would be the sorts of disciplines which would apply to a détente, red line, strategic competition, strategic collaboration spectrum under such a scenario.
Looking to the geostrategic balance in Asia, I asked David to describe America's interest in the region and to consider whether the U.S. would accept the Chinese sphere of influence taking hold.
You know, I think it's a challenging question, but I don't think there's places that we would consciously let the Chinese sphere take hold without, from a U.S. perspective, without deep consideration, because each and every move and countermove begins to set a precedent and so forth. You know, the the beginning point is the premise that the United States is a Pacific nation, that we have huge interest in the Pacific, that we play an enormously important role of stability, both from a commercial, economic standpoint and also from a military standpoint in the region. And that we take that responsibility, which is go on beyond just protecting U.S. interest directly, but protecting the interests of our key allies like Japan, Australia, and so forth. And so a strategy of incrementalism that allows for a concession here on this island or a concession there or, you know, some challenge of the law of the sea principles that allows U.S. carriers or U.S. subs to exercise their independence in certain parts of the Pacific. Those compromises are of great significance, not so much because some little empty island in the middle of nowhere makes that much difference strategically, but because the precedent that's established by not responding is deeply problematic. And so, you know, that's not a black and white thing. There's choices and there's clarity of claims in each of the different cases. But there's no doubt that China's thinking very holistically about two things. One is how to build a capability, a sea-based capability in the Pacific and in particular the Taiwanese Straits and the South China Sea that has, you know, enormous defensive capability and power projection capability. There's that, I think that's indisputable. And the second thing that's indisputable is that on a number of these fronts, it's advancing an agenda of territorial acknowledgement slash expansion. And so how to handle that in a way that recognizes the severity of the precedent, but also is wary of the risk of escalation is a real balancing act for any administration. But I don't think one would come into it thinking what concessions are we willing to make because each one of those has follow-on effect.
In the second session, Kevin outlined his view of how Chinese leadership thinks about the geostrategic environment and the balance of power with the United States. The audio recording of his contents is what follows.
The three things the Chinese have in their matrix. One, the balance of military power, which Dave has spoken about effectively. That will, in China's estimate, change more decisively in their direction by about the mid-2020s, maybe the end of the 2020s. But they want to be also ahead of the curve of the American, as it were, build back. The second criteria in the matrix is this, dollar dependency in the international financial system. And therefore, watching what they're doing in terms of dollar exposure with treasuries, watching what they're doing in terms of the exchange rate, watching what they're doing in terms of capital account liberalizations of one form or another, is a critical second litmus here. And the third thing they are worried about in the matrix is semiconductors, which at present they see as the third ultimate anchoring point of American power. Therefore, watching what happens in this space, and if we align these three lines and see a convergence or crossover point between the three of them in a fairly decisive way by mid to late 2020s, that's a time when we should be getting acutely concerned.
Ray, David, given all that we've discussed, how do you see the arc of the relationship advancing and the balance of power between the United States and China changing with time? Come 2030, can we know which country will be the dominant power?
In answering that question, one has to think about the dimensions of power and what they imply. So there's obviously economic capability, economic rigor, economic growth. That's one key factor of power. There's military capability, defense capability. That's a second. Related to one and two is technology leadership, because technology leadership not only applies where you are in the moment, but where you're headed. And in the world that we're headed into, some of these emergent technologies have enormous consequences. There's the strength of your value system and how that influences others in the world and how that sets the stage for how your population interacts with its government and what level of support it has. And then there's alliances and partnerships around the world that are force multipliers in power, right? Because if China and India are, you know, really close friends and have enormously successful economic relationships, that is a source of power and influence in the global economy. So to answer that question, I think you have to really go systematically through them. I'm of the mind that by numbers, in terms of the size of the economy, China is growing very quickly, and you know it's hard to predict the future, but it's not unlikely at all that China will be a much larger economy than the United States in the decades that come. That would make a lot of sense given its population. And if you think about per capita GDP or growth, it's likely on a path to do that. I think the question of defense capability and technological leadership are still very much open questions. And I think it'll depend a lot on what the United States does. I think if it innovates and continues to do the right policies to ensure technology leadership, have the right kinds of talent engaged on the right kinds of problems, the right kinds of investment in R&D, the right kinds of innovations on the defense side, I think on those two dimensions, I think there's lots of possibility that the United States could very much be in a position of leadership, but that'll require action. It's like anything else, that'll require action. You know, on position of values and leadership in the world, and alliances, I think that also depends on, you know, what we do. You know, in a very biased way, this is a very American-centric position. I think the underlying values of freedom and liberty and what the United States was founded on is a huge strategic advantage, because it gives a level of autonomy and self-ruling capability to the United States that makes it much more adaptable over time. But that's an experiment that's still in its early days. And when I say early days, we're only a couple hundred years into this. And so we'll have to see. But that's a judgment. That's a values judgment. And on the question of alliances, I think we have a huge opportunity, in part because of the value system, to continue to build on the post-World War II institutions, in some cases eliminate them and build new ones, post-World War II institutions and relationships that are a huge source of benefit in the world, because, you know, for all its challenges, this is still the number one destination, the United States is still the number one destination in the world for people who want to come and live great lives and build a great country. And so that is a source of advantage too. We have to treat those alliances well. We have to treat those, we have to reform those institutions. So I think the by and large is that it depends on what we do. In the United States, we're at a particular inflection point, and I think with the right policies and positions and leadership, the United States will play a very critical leadership role in the world for, you know, many decades to come.
You must look at what they're doing, both countries are doing domestically as well as internationally. What I'm trying to convey is kind of the tripwires or the red lines to signal if you go over them, you have to pretty much think about what might be the worst case scenario. And if you stay within them, you can see what is more likely to be the most likely scenario, which is that you don't have an intolerable scenario. And so which of those paths you go on will be very important. The big bad one, or the evolutionary one. The more likely one, the more likely evolutionary one, is that you don't have the hot war. You have a lot of confrontations and banging into each other, and then you'll expect more independence in the future, and probably a more powerful, stronger Chinese situation, because they're developing the innovation that's going on there, the capitalism in the usage of entrepreneurship and what Shenzhen means and all of that. It's the right path to create development, to create innovation, and so on.
We hope you enjoyed this first installment of our series on U.S.-China relations. In part two, Ray, Kevin, and David will consider how the domains of economic competition, including trade, technology, and capital control policies, may evolve in the coming decade. We look forward to sharing it with you.